Very good. So this is this comment is authored by Daniel Lowenstein. He says, and you're watching Aleph Beta. Welcome to Parshat Ve'et Hanan. And you can see that this is the portion in which Moses pleads with God regarding allowing him into the promised land. And this is one of the occasions when the Lord speaks to Moses and said, Moshala, you know, I mean, you're not going into the promised land with your people, so please, you know, just stop asking me about this. It's a difficult section to read because of Moses' faithfulness, but we're going to continue. Towards the end of this week's Parsha, the children of Israel are reminded that they'll soon be entering the promised land, and when they get there, they'll have to drive out the seven Canaanite nations, and there's more. Beyond driving them out, Moses details three additional prohibitions related to the Canaanite people. Lo tichrot lahem berit, don't make any covenants with them. V'lo techanem, don't show them any favor. And finally, lo techaten bam, don't intermarry with them. In other words, these laws are basically saying, hey, Israelites, you need to keep your distance from these Canaanite nations. You're a holy people, and we wanted to keep it that way. Now, you probably remember that when Israel does go in and take possession of the land, it takes them a lengthy period of time to conquer the land and to dispossess the nations, but they don't drive all of the nations out completely. What happens is that they are told additionally to see that these nations are driven out, and they must be driven out over time. And these three prohibitions are associated with that period of time while the Canaanites still live in the land, and they're still being driven out slowly but surely is the objective. Don't make any covenants with them, don't show them any special favor, and don't intermarry with them. In other words, these laws are basically saying, hey, Israelites, you need to keep your distance from these Canaanite nations, and we want to keep it that way. But then Moshe makes these laws with a statement that seems like it comes completely out of nowhere. He says, Lo mirubchem mikol ha'amim chashak Hashem b'chem v'yivchar b'chem. It's not because of your vast numbers that God desired you and chose you. Ki atem ha'at mikol ha'amim, because you're actually the smallest of all the nations. Ki me'achavat Hashem etchem. Rather, it's because of his great love for you. Now, is that the next thing you'd expect Moshe to say? Don't make deals with the Canaanites. Don't show them favor. Don't intermarry with them. And oh yeah, you're really small. But that's okay. God doesn't care about that. It's totally out of left field. Everything here is about the Israelites keeping their distance from the nations of the land. What does the fact that the Israelites are small and God loves them anyway have anything to do with that? Well, actually, I think that being small does belong. It does have something to do with making deals with foreign nations and showing them favor and intermarrying. We just don't see it yet. So we need to dig a little deeper. And here's why I think that. There's another place in the Torah, a story, where we also encounter this idea of the Israelites being small. And the crazy thing is, we also find all these other elements in this story. It's a story about making deals with Canaanite nations, about showing favor, and about intermarrying. So maybe if we see how everything fits together in that story, we can understand what's going on here. It's the story of Dinah. In Bereshit, in the book of Genesis, chapter 34, we learn about the rape of Yaakov's daughter, Dinah, at the hands of a Canaanite noble, Shechem. Shechem falls in love with Dinah and decides he wants to marry her. So his father, Hamor, approaches Yaakov to ask for her hand. And then he adds something. V'hit chatnu otanu. Let our families intermarry. Banotechem titnu lanu, ve'et banotenu titnu lachem, tichu lachem. You'll give us your daughters, and you can take our daughters. Did you hear that? Intermarriage. There's our first connection to Davarim. Hamor is proposing that his Canaanite tribe and the family of Yaakov, of Jacob, intermarry. And the word that the Torah uses is even the same, v'hit chatnu and tit chaten. It comes from the Hebrew word chatan. If you're familiar with a Jewish wedding or have ever been to a Jewish wedding, the bridegroom is called a chatan, right? So this is the verbal root that this particular word comes from, right? So it can be used as a verb or a noun, and it refers to marriage. It refers to getting married, which, by the way, in this particular case, interestingly, are the only two places this word is used in the Torah. And that line about exchanging daughters, Benotechem titnu lanu, ve'et benotenu titnu lachem. Look at how intermarriage is explained in Devarim. Bitacha lotiten livno, uvito lotitach livnecha. Don't give your daughter to his son, and don't take his daughter for your son. They're practically carbon copies of each other. So there definitely seems to be some connection between the prohibition of intermarriage in Devarim and Hamor's offer here. But what about the other elements we saw in Devarim? The prohibitions against making deals and showing favor, and the idea of being a small nation. Are those here too? So let's keep going and see. Hamor makes his intermarriage pitch, and then he tries to sweeten the pot by offering even more. He says, V'itanu teshevu v'ha'aretz tihiye lifnechem. Dwell among us. The land will be open before you. Shevu usharucha v'he achzuba. Settle it. Trade and acquire property. And then Shechem pipes up and offers even more. He says, Emtsachen be'enechem v'asher tomru alai eten. I want to find favor in your eyes. Whatever you ask of me, I will give it. Harbu alai me'od mohar umaten ve'etna ka'asher tomru alai. Ask for a huge dowry. Pile it on, and I'll give whatever you ask. Did you notice what Shechem said he was trying to do? Emtsachen be'enechem. He was trying to find favor in the eyes of Jacob and his family. So there's our second connection. Shechem is hoping to be shown favor. The Hebrew word is chen. I have the two consonants of the word in highlighted and in blue. And in Devarim, the Israelites are told, Lo tichanem, don't show favor to the Canaanites. And you can see the same letters in the bolded text in that next phrase. The only difference is, in the first one, the chen, the last letter is a final nun, and in the second one, Tichanem, the nun is in the form it is when it's in the middle of a word. It's one of the letters that changes forms depending upon where it is in a word. Okay? If you take a step back and think about what's happening here, the whole conversation, the offer of intermarriage, of living together and trading with one another, isn't that all a negotiation, an attempt to establish terms for an ongoing relationship? In other words, Shechem and Hamor are trying to arrange a deal to make a covenant, which gives us a third connection. Shechem and Hamor are trying to establish a covenant. And in Devarim, the Torah forbids us making covenants with the Canaanites. It's wild. So far, we found everything we found in Devarim seems to be showing up here in the story about Jacob's family all the way on the other side of the Torah. And by the way, we may not be the first ones to notice these connections, because if you open up the Talmud, you'll find that the sages actually interpret Lo Tichanem, that phrase from Devarim, in a really interesting way. They say it means don't show favor, but that it also has two additional, more specific meanings. Don't offer land to settle, and don't offer gifts. And what were the two specific offers that Hamor and Shechem made to Jacob? Itanu teshavu v'ha'aretz tihyeh lifneichem. Dwell with us and settle the land. And harbu alai me'od me'od umatan. Demand whatever bridal gifts you want, land and gifts, the same things. It almost feels like the sages were reading these two sections together the same way we are. But there's one thing that's still missing. We've seen how closely our laws in Devarim and the story in Bereshit are connected. But there's one connection we haven't seen yet, the one we came here to find, the idea of being small. Does the story of Dinah and Shechem, in Hebrew it's Shechem is the way it's pronounced, Shechem is the kind of the anglicized form, talk about how the Israelites are a small nation. Let's go to the end of the story. Yaakov's sons agree to the deal on one condition. Hamor has to convince all the men of his city to become circumcised. Hamor agrees, and all the men get circumcisions. But soon after, while the men are recovering and vulnerable, two of Yaakov's sons, Shimon and Levi, massacre them all and rescue Dinah. When Yaakov hears about this, he's incensed. He can't believe what they've done. He says to them, "Do you know what you've brought down upon us? Do you know the reputation you've given me? You've just made enemies of all the nations in the land." And listen to what he says next. "Va'ani mate mispar. I'm so few in number. V'nei esfu alai v'kuni. They'll all gather against me and spite me. V'nish medti ani uveti. And my household and I will be destroyed." Did you catch it? The ani mate mispar, Yaakov says. I'm so few in number. He's afraid for his survival because his family is so small. There's our fourth element. God in Devarim calls the very same family, now the children of Israel, the smallest of the nations. So it all lines up. The story in Bereshit shares all of the elements we saw in Devarim. So we have all these parallels, but we still haven't answered our original question. What does being small have anything to do with all the prohibitions of getting close to the Canaanites? Is there something about the story of Dinah that can help us understand how they're connected? I think there is. And you can see it if you just put yourself in Yaakov's shoes. So let's do that. Let's imagine what this crisis with Dina must have been like for him. Here you are, living in the land of Israel, surrounded by foreign peoples, the Havi, the Sena'ani, the Perizi, there's others as well, and your whole nation consists of you, your wives, and your 12 kids. You're tiny, and that makes you vulnerable. Now, for a while, none of these foreign nations, neighbors, have made any trouble. They've left you alone. But then the unthinkable happens. A powerful local noble rapes your daughter and decides he wants her for himself. And yet, he doesn't whisk her away. He doesn't demand her with a show of force. He doesn't even make any veiled threats. Instead, he comes with an offer of peace and gestures of goodwill. And all he wants is to marry your daughter. So, what do you say? Well, if we think about Yaakov the way we're used to, we'd all expect him to say no without a second thought. After all, we know that his parents, Yitzhak and Rivka, and his grandfather, Avraham, placed a lot of importance on marrying within the family, on not marrying children off to the Canaanites. And now, this foreign man who forced himself on Dina wants to make a deal where he'll get to marry her, and Yaakov's sons will marry his city's Canaanite women. Agreeing would be like spitting in Dina's face and in the face of family tradition. What's to think about? And yet, I don't think it was that simple. Put yourself back in Yaakov's shoes and ask yourself, what will happen if you say no? What will happen if you spurn these people, if you provoke them? All you are is one small little family. Maybe they'll just take Dina anyway. Maybe they'll take all the women. Maybe they'll go to war. And this isn't just speculation. We know that Yaakov felt physically vulnerable. Remember how he responded after Shimon and Levi commit their massacre? He says, Ve'ani mate mispar. I am so few in number. Ve'ne esvu alai ve'hikuni. They'll all gather against me and smite me. He's afraid because Shimon and Levi just provoked all the surrounding nations. He fears getting attacked. He fears retribution. Yaakov knows how vulnerable he is. His small size must have been weighing on him. And that means that as much as he might have wanted to say no, it couldn't have been an easy thing to do. And maybe that part partly explains Yaakov's behavior in this story. Because Yaakov never gives Shechem and Hamor an answer. His children jump in and respond, but he doesn't say anything. The commentators all have different theories about what this silence means. But I wonder if part of it has to do with how conflicted he was over this dilemma. And maybe that's the way all our elements connect. When you're small, when you're vulnerable, then making alliances, currying favor, creating ties through intermarriage can start to seem like the sensible thing to do. It can even become tempting. And if the opportunity to forge these ties comes along, how can you just pass it up? And you know what? Yaakov wasn't the only person in our history to struggle with these issues, to have fears about his people's vulnerability, fears that could tempt him to get too close to his neighbors. It would also be an issue for the Israelites when they began their conquest of the Promised Land and were again surrounded by nations who seemed more powerful than them. And so generations later, God comes along and gives the Israelites a set of laws governing how they are supposed to relate to foreign nations. Don't make deals, don't grant favor, and don't intermarry. And he reminds them, it's not because you are large in number that I chose you. That doesn't matter. The laws in Devarim are telling us that whenever we face this dilemma, there can be only one answer. Yes, there will be times when important concerns, like physical and political security, will make covenants and intermarriage seem like great ideas, but they're not. The price is too high. Because you know what happens when we intermarry? The Torah tells us, and history bears it out. V'lo tichaten bam, bitcha lo titen livno, uvito lo tikach livnecha. Don't intermarry with the Canaanites. Don't give your daughter to his son, and don't take his daughter for your son. Ki yasir et bincha me'acharai. Because if you do, your son will be led astray, away from God. Our physical limitations, our vulnerability, God can deal with that. He didn't choose us because we're big enough to defend ourselves. He chose us to be holy. And as long as we're doing that, he can handle the protection. And his final comment, but when we bring corrupting influences into our lives, even for the best of reasons, even in the name of peace, when we let ourselves be led away from holiness, then we're giving too much away. We're jeopardizing our own souls. So there's a few comments that I wanted to make with regard to the issues that this particular passage elicits. Daniel Lowenstein mentions. The first one is Shamor and Hamor are trying to arrange a deal to make a covenant which gives us a third connection. Shechem and Hamor are trying to establish a covenant. And in Devarim, the Torah forbids us making covenants with the Canaanites. There's a few passages in the other parts of the scripture that addresses these issues too. One is in Jeremiah 23, where it says, "The Lord has driven out before you great and powerful nations. To this day, no one has been able to withstand you. One of you routs 1,000 because the Lord your God fights for you, just as he promised. So be very careful to love the Lord your God. But if you turn away and ally yourselves with the survivors of these nations that remain among you, and if you intermarry with them and associate with them, then you may be sure that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. Instead, they will become snares and traps for you, whips on your backs and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which the Lord your God has given you." So, this from the book of Joshua, the people have settled the land. The tribes have been allocated their portions. They've driven out many of the Canaanites, but, right, there are still Canaanites living in the land who engage in idolatrous practices. And this is one of the things that's important about this particular section, this particular quote from the book of Joshua, the story we just read regarding Shechem and Hamor, and what Moses says in the Torah in Deuteronomy 7. If you intermarry with them and associate with them, then you may be sure that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. Instead, they will become snares and traps for you. So before we move on to the passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, I want to ask a question. Do you think God is referring to Jews marrying non-Jews in this story of Shechem and Hamor? Or is the Lord talking about Jews not marrying people who engage in idolatry? Now, the problem is that in this time, it was true for the most part that the non-Jews, the Gentiles living in the land, did engage in idolatry. But that can certainly not be said about many Gentiles living in the land who connected themselves to God's people and who did intermarry with members of Israel's 12 tribes, right? And there are remarkable stories about them, about their faith, about their commitment to God and their commitment to his people. People like Rahab, for example, right, who the spies came across in the city of Jericho, who hid them, right, and who essentially betrayed her own people so that she and her family might live. But the fact is, she didn't engage in idolatry. She was a Gentile, but she was not a pagan. She did not engage in idolatry. And there are stories of many others, too. Ruth, Tamar, right? I mean, there are many stories. Naaman the leper. There are stories of Gentiles, people who have a heart for God, who ultimately turn to God, like the Ninevites, or like the people in the book of Esther, who convert to Judaism after all of the events associated with Haman's attempt to destroy God's people. But the fact of the matter is that I think it's important to distinguish between whether or not God is referring to intermarriage between Jews and Gentiles or intermarriage between Jews and idolaters. And in my opinion, I think that he prohibits the intermarriage of Jews to idolaters, right? And in my view, that's an important consideration, particularly when we come to a passage like this one in 2 Corinthians 6. Do not be yoked together with unbelievers, for what do righteousness and wickedness have in common? Most people understand this passage to mean that Christians should not marry non-Christians, right? That's the way passages like this are taken. Is that what it means? Is that what Paul intends, right? The problem, of course, with understanding it this way is there were no Christians when Paul wrote this letter to the Corinthians, right? So it can't refer to something that didn't exist at the time. Now, there were believers and unbelievers, right? There were believers among both Jews and Gentiles at this time, and unbelievers among both Jews and Gentiles at this time. But look at what he goes on to say. For what do righteousness and wickedness have in common? Or what fellowship can light have with darkness? And then he's not satisfied with the point he's made yet, and he says it a third time. This is the third time. What harmony is there between Messiah and Satan? Messiah and Belial, right? Or what does a believer have in common with an unbeliever? Or what agreement is there between the temple of God, and notice this is the fifth time he says it, and idols? So I think in this passage too, Paul is making a remez to these instructions in the book of Deuteronomy and charging the believers in Corinth not to intermarry with idol worshippers, right? Not to intermarry with Canaanites, with the Hivites, with the Jebusites, with the Amorites, with the others in the land who engage in idolatry. I mean, he comes right out and says it, right? It's not as if this is a speculation. He says, what agreement is there between the temple of God and idols? And then he says, for we are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will live among them and walk among them. I will be their God. They will be my people. A quote from Leviticus 26. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Touch no unclean thing, and I will receive you, in Isaiah 52. And of course, if you look back at Isaiah 52, that's precisely what Isaiah was criticizing the people for doing, engaging in idolatry, right? Turning away from God and serving false gods. And Isaiah isn't the only one who spoke about it. Many of the prophets talked about the degree to which the people engaged in idolatry. They had turned away from the Lord and engaged in idolatry. And I will be a father to you, and you will be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. And this passage is quoted from 2 Samuel chapter 7 and Hosea chapter 1. In 1 Corinthians 10, his earlier work to the Corinthians, this is a reiteration of what he says earlier in his previous letter. Therefore, my dear friends, flee from idolatry. I speak to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say. Is not the cup of thanksgiving for which we give thanks a participation in the blood of the Messiah? This is an allusion to the Passover, right? And the various cups that we drink, the various cups of wine that we drink at Passover, the one is an allusion to the blood of the Messiah. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons, too. You cannot have a part in both the Lord's table and the table of demons. Are we trying to arouse the Lord's jealousy? Are we stronger than he? So idolatry is an issue which Paul addresses in his letters to various kehilot, primarily because of where they were located, right? They were located in places where there was a good deal of idolatry, and in places like Corinth and in Ephesus. Corinth in particular, it was a big problem. In Acts chapter 15, there is another passage that addresses this. We should write to the Gentiles, telling them to abstain from food polluted by idols, from sexual immorality, from the meat of strangled animals, and from blood. These four restrictions, and by the way, Acts 15 is the chapter in which the community of believers gathers together in Jerusalem to determine how Gentiles get saved. Because there were believers among the Jews living in Jerusalem who believed, like Peter did at one time, that Gentiles had to convert to Judaism in order to be saved, right? And James makes a decision that no, that's not the case. I mean, even Jews aren't saved because they're Jews. So why require Gentiles to convert to Judaism to be saved? That's not how we're saved, right? We're saved because we trust God. We worship God as the one and only God, the creator of the heaven and the earth. And each of these things that James prohibits are connected in the Bible with idolatry, right? So what James is essentially saying, what Gentiles have to do to be saved is to turn away from idolatry, right? Now, of course, that's a big problem in our time. I mean, it's not the problem today as it was in biblical times. I mean, essentially all non-Jews were pagans, right? But the word pagan and Gentile, they're not synonymous. They don't mean the same thing. I mean, a Gentile just means a person of an ethnic group, a particular ethnic group. That's it. Has no religious connotation, no negative connotation whatsoever. And in fact, in the Bible, the nation of Israel is also referred to as a goy, as a nation, right? And the goyim is a reference to the nations that are not Israel. The point is that many people today who don't engage in idolatry don't understand the difference between what things are like today and what they were like in biblical times, when non-Jews, for the most part, not all, but for the most part, did engage in idolatry. And idolatry was a problem in biblical times. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, a little earlier, he says, "To the rest I say this, I, not the Lord, if any brother has a wife who is not a believer, and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer, and he is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him." Right? Here's another example where Paul requires the exact same thing of women and men. Right? He doesn't require anything of men that he doesn't require of women. He doesn't require anything of women that he doesn't of men. Paul thinks of women and men as equals. Right? He goes on to say, "For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the opposite is true, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband." Right? So, obviously, in the early Messianic congregations, right, there were marriages between believers and non-believers, right? But not believers and idolaters. So, I want to move on to point number two. And we'll discuss this, and then we'll have our discussion. But when we bring corrupting influences into our lives, even for the best of reasons, even in the name of peace, when we let ourselves be led away from holiness, then we're giving away too much. We're jeopardizing our own souls. Notice this passage from 1 Kings chapter 11. This is a very sad story that involves King Solomon. It says of King Solomon, who was ostensibly the wisest man who ever lived, but in this matter, he did not exercise wisdom. And in fact, he violates the instructions, the specific instructions in the Torah, that a king should not do some of the things that Solomon does. It says, King Solomon loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter. In verse 2, they were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, "You must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods." And this is a quote from the passage that we just read in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 3. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. I've mentioned before that the word love in Hebrew is used in a variety of different ways. I could say, "I love my wife. I loved a movie that I saw recently. I love my brother. I love my sister. I love a dear friend." I could even say, "I love popcorn," right? "I love ice cream. I love cinnamon rolls." In Greek, I would use different words for all those things, but not in Hebrew. In Hebrew, there's just one word. I love, right? So, we don't really know what this word means. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. This may express the idea that he was committed to them. We don't know how wholeheartedly he loved them. I mean, that's the way the text sounds in English, but the Hebrew word for love, ahava, has a wide range of meanings, right? Maybe it just means that he was he was pleased with them, or he was enamored with them, or, you know, he cared for them, whatever. It doesn't necessarily mean that he loved them in the way that love between a husband and a wife is typically defined. At any rate, he had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines. And notice what it says, his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely. And again, it reiterates this idea, as David his father had done. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives, who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. Right? It's difficult to imagine someone having 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, right? I mean, Solomon obviously believed, among other things, that negotiating alliances with foreign powers was a good thing. And by the way, it continues, that practice continues, into our current times. Royals from various houses, from various nations of the world, often intermarry. It has nothing to do with love. It has everything to do with political alliances, right? That's the way nations have historically been aligned with one another, connected with one another. Because what happens is that the descendants or the children of one royal line marry the descendants or the children of a different married line, and they thereby seal a covenant or a connection between them, right? So it's been going on for a long time. That's what Shechem and Hamor had in mind. That's what they were hoping for. But the scripture specifically says that that is not something we should do. The passage that we draw this from is in Deuteronomy 12. These are the decrees and the laws you must be careful to follow in the land that the Lord, the God of your ancestors, has given you to possess as long as you live in the land. Destroy completely all the places on the high mountains, on the hills, and under every spreading tree where the nations you are dispossessing worship their gods. What did Solomon do? Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Amorites. And he did the same for all his foreign wives. So there were hundreds and hundreds of places throughout the land of Judah where an altar had been erected to a false god, and where Solomon's wives and the others that were in their service went to worship, right? And it even implies that Solomon participated in these activities too, right? It says that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God. This statement in Hebrew means that, you know, Solomon did not only give a place for his wives to worship other gods, but participated in the worship of these gods. In other words, attended services, attended events, went to things, right? He went to things as the king of Judah, right? Certainly not a member of a particular cult. He certainly didn't go, to the high place where Chemosh was worshipped, or the high place where Molech was worshipped, right? To worship Molech or Chemosh or any of the other gods. But the fact of the matter is that he did participate in some way. It goes on to say, break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, burn their Asherah poles in the fire, cut down the idols of their gods, and wipe out their names from those places. You must not worship the Lord your God in their way. From Deuteronomy 12, later in the same book, the Lord your God will cut off before you the nations you are about to invade and dispossess. But when you have driven them out and settled in their land, and after they have been destroyed before you, be careful not to be ensnared by inquiring about their gods, saying, how do these nations serve their gods? We will do the same. You must not worship the Lord your God in their way, because in worshiping their gods, they do all kinds of detestable things that the Lord hates. They even burn their sons and daughters in the fire as sacrifices to their gods, right? So these are strong words. I sometimes talk or share some thoughts about this, in the springtime, closer to the celebration of Easter, but it seemed appropriate to bring it up today. And I want you to see that this is a quote from a particular website, Your Guide to Celebrating Easter with Your Children. Colorful eggs, rabbits, chicks, and candy. There are many fun and engaging activities to try with your child this Easter. Enjoy the best the holiday has to offer. And then in the same article, it goes on to say, what is Easter? And then notice that the answer to the question begins with the word traditionally. Traditionally, Easter is a religious holiday that annually celebrates the resurrection of Yeshua, right? Easter is not a religious holiday that annually celebrates the resurrection of Yeshua. Easter is a religious holiday, but it has nothing to do with Yeshua and everything to do with Ashtart, everything to do with spring, right? Everything to do with the spring equinox, everything to do with the renewal that takes place in the spring. And that's why there are eggs and rabbits and chicks associated with it, right? I don't know if you've ever given any thought to this, but how did eggs, rabbits, chicks, and candy come to be associated with a holiday that celebrates the resurrection of Yeshua? But it goes on to say, in modern times, it is also held to celebrate the joys of spring. Even if you're not religious, right? Even if you have no interest whatsoever in the resurrection of Yeshua, Easter can be an exciting holiday for you and your family. And with a little help from this article, Easter will surely become a part of your annual traditions, right? So I've always been struck by the images of children celebrating the resurrection of Yeshua. And this is one, this young girl with an Easter basket. You can see the colorful eggs inside. And if you look on the next page, there is another picture the annual Easter celebration at the George Bush Presidential Library and Museum. And it says that it offers fun for families. And by the way, you can look all these articles up. They're all footnoted, right? But notice how the Greenwich, Connecticut synagogues are celebrating Passover this year and where to find kosher food. So in the one picture, the top picture is a picture of kids learning how to celebrate Passover in school, right? In their synagogue school in Greenwich, Connecticut, right? This is kind of a interesting contrast. And this is a contrast which has always struck me. When Christians talk about Easter, they want it to be associated with the resurrection of the Messiah, right? But the resurrection of the Messiah, it already has a holiday associated with it. It's called the Feast of First Fruits, right? It comes on the day after the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is the first day of the 7 days of Passover. So, historically, the early believers, when they celebrated the resurrection of Yeshua, they didn't celebrate it in connection with the worship of the Greek goddess Ashtart, Easter, right? They celebrated it because it commemorated the resurrection of Messiah, and it didn't take place at the same time every year. It had nothing to do with the spring equinox, because the spring equinox was irrelevant for the celebration of this holiday. The spring equinox is something that is dictated by the cycle of the sun. And the Jewish holidays, although they are adjusted to fit the cycle of the sun, they're all lunar holidays, right? So, the Feast of First Fruits happens on the 16th of Nisan. The 15th of Nisan is the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the 14th of Nisan is the Feast of Passover, right? But notice that in the Christian community, the celebration of Easter has become a separate, it's not separate, unfortunately, but it's become very much, and maybe that's the intention, to separate Easter from a celebration of the resurrection. But they're always connected together, and they're associated with the spring equinox, which is a celebration of spring, right? And you can understand why the church fathers did this. They moved the celebration of the resurrection of Yeshua from the days of Passover and connected it to an existing pagan commemoration, which is what the church did and still does and has done for centuries, right? That's why the Catholic Church is regarded as a syncretistic religion, because they synchronized the celebration of Yeshua's resurrection with a current celebration celebrating new life, spring, right? And it shares some of the same elements, obviously. I mean, spring does commemorate new life. I mean, who isn't grateful for spring, especially when you live in a place that is cold and snowy for 4 or 6 months of the year? Spring is glorious, right? I mean, plants come back to life. You see animals coming back. I mean, it's wonderful. That is something that is emphasized in the resurrection. I mean, it has to do with new life, too. So the associations aren't accidental, and it was a way that the early church Christianized pagan Rome. That's one of the things that they did. Okay? Now, I know we're a little over the time, but I wanted to add this one thing. My objective here is not to determine if whether or not you should or should not, color eggs and celebrate these things with your kids. That's not up to me. This is not something I'm trying to impose on you. It's something that I'd like you to think about, right? Something else that is important, though, is according to the rabbis, because we live so long after the initial syncretistic events took place, people who do celebrate Easter as Easter, it has nothing to do with Ashtart, and they are therefore not engaging in idolatry, right? The rabbis would say that in the beginning, right, in the third, fourth, and fifth centuries, when the celebration of Yeshua was moved to the spring equinox and connected with Easter, the rabbis would have said, yes, those who engage in the worship of Ashtart as a cover for celebrating the resurrection of Yeshua, it is idolatry, right? But nobody is aware of that these days, right? I mean, it's just a fun thing to do. Color eggs together as a family, bury the eggs, have your kids look for them. It's a treasure hunt. I mean, is there a kid on the planet who doesn't like a treasure hunt? Probably not, right? But I think it is important to decide if whether or not this is what you want to teach your child about the resurrection of the Messiah, right? Is that the way you want them to understand the resurrection of the Messiah? Or is it this way, going to a camp where they make their own matzah, right? Because the matzah is unleavened bread. And and at the resurrection, a bare grain was offered to the Lord, not leavened bread, leavened dough. A bare grain was offered to the Lord. Now that speaks of the Messiah in a very intentional and deliberate way. So our objective is to try to come to terms with some of the practices we practice and to determine if whether or not we are engaging in things with our children and grandchildren that actually weakens the fabric of their ability to trust God. Okay, so I'm going to stop here and be happy to entertain comments or questions. Anybody?
Hi, Rabbi.
Yeah.
I think the lesson of today is, a call to be brave, right? I mean, we have this conversation with you when I was in your home, and we talked about how difficult it is to sometimes feel isolated, right?
Yes.
Because when a person starts trying to read the Bible through the lens of the Hebrew perspective, I mean, you start to be conscious about a lot of things, right? So by moments, I mean, you not share any more values with the Christian perspective. And by the other hand, it's hard to sometimes connect with a Jewish community. And sometimes, in order to have this kind of community with some church or friends or whatever, some of us, take a little bit of our terms in faith are very superficial, and I mean, this lesson make us think in our faith terms about what is going on, about what we are doing and why. we are being part of this thing. So I think that well, I have several years that I'm not part of Christmas celebration or things like that. But this kind of lesson made me even think about Christianity in general, you know, because today we have seen how serious is to be in celebrations where are related to other gods or pagan practices that are not connected with the Bible, and here is a comment and a question that how far we can take this, you know, because even in Christianity, it's hard, you know, to connect with friends, because sometimes even the Bible festivities, the people used to change the meaning, you know, of those festivities, right? I think this is a call to be brave, because it's not easy.
No, it's not.
To say about this. And for example, my family, they are Baptist Christians, and I mean, we join in the dinner with everybody, and it has been hard, you know, during the years when they come and they start making questions, and obviously I happily answer their questions, you know, but the tough part is when they deeply criticize, even with hard words, you know, why the family or I have to consider it celebrate Christmas or another festivity that is a Greek festivity, right?
Right.
So I think that the lesson of today is kind of hard. It's serious because we are called to review the purposes of why we sometimes participate in these kind of things, you know? And there are so many attractive celebrations in the Western world that we are not part of, and we are also isolated. So the question is, when Christians used to change the purpose of the festivities, I mean, that is idolatry too, you know, because they are changing the purpose of what the Bible says, right? So in what point, in your experience, I mean, you make peace with what you have learned, and peace with this sense of isolation, that if you if we put ourselves in a very strict way of thinking, we are going to be even more isolated. So,
right. So it is very difficult to know what to do in situations like this, because as I mentioned, when you come across texts like this, you think to yourself that any expression, any blending of pagan and religious traditions is idolatry. But the problem is that most Christians, for example, you brought up Christmas. Most Christians, for example, actually believe that Yeshua was born on December 25th, and have no idea whatsoever that was the birth of the Persian sun god Mithras, and everything having to do with Christmas is also connected with paganism, right? I mean, that's the issue. The issue is, to what extent are people aware of the changes that have taken place over time? And that is the view of the rabbis, that those who are not aware of the connection, right, should not be regarded as engaging in idolatry, because it's not something that is done consciously or intentionally or willfully or knowingly, right? So it kind of puts this in a different I don't want to say category, but a different kind of a perspective, right? That for people who are not aware of these things, we can say whatever it is that we want to about these things, but the fact is, they should not be condemned for engaging in practices that they are not aware of or have no knowledge of. In other words, they're not doing anything wrong intentionally, right? The traditions, the pagan traditions and Christian traditions, have been blended for a very, very long time. And at this point, people tend not to be aware of where the traditions intersect, right? And how they intersected, where they came from. Once you find out about these things, then it becomes more of an issue, because you have to decide for yourself, you know, do I want to spend time with my family on Christmas, the part of the family that celebrates Christmas, even if I don't? Is it okay on Easter, for example, to go to a family member's home where the family has gathered? You know, they've gathered for Easter, but the bottom line is that when you get together with family on a holiday like Easter, or on a holiday like Thanksgiving, or on a holiday like Christmas, I mean, the only thing you're really doing is meeting with family and spending time together, right? So, is that something that we should not do? I would say no, right? I would say that it's okay to, to engage with the family when opportunities present themselves, but not to engage in practices that are inappropriate, right? So, is that an easy thing to do? No, it's not an easy thing to do, and it depends a lot on the timing, for example, when you show up at something, how long you stay, right? But getting together with loved ones, you know, is important, and that should take a priority over some other things. But we still have to be careful. In my opinion, we still have to be careful. So when my children were growing up, we did spend time with family members at various events, but did not engage in some of the practices associated with those events. And we made that very clear to people that we could not, because we were not comfortable with them, right? So it wasn't particularly popular, but that's kind of what we did, right? And we wanted people to know that we loved them, and we were there to see them, but not to do or engage in certain things, right? And so, and then when it was a holiday that we celebrated, of course, they were invited to our house, and they could come and participate in the holiday or not, right? It was up to them. But participating in a holiday, I mean, when you go to someone's home for Passover, for example, you don't just eat a meal together. You celebrate Passover. So it's not quite the same. You know, after the Easter egg hunt is over and after all the candy baskets are, you know, the baskets are all uncovered and, you know, and you have dinner. I mean, aside from, you know, saying a blessing over the meal, I mean, the dinner itself has nothing to do with Easter. Right? It's just a dinner. It's just a meal. Right? I mean, it's like getting together with family to observe the 4th of July. Right? I mean, apart from the fireworks that people may set off in places where they're legal, you get together for a barbecue, and that's, you know, there's nothing, you know, it's just a dinner. The dinner itself provides the occasion for the, you know, in other words, the holiday provides the occasion for the dinner because people are off work. But it's just a dinner. Nobody probably discusses, maybe they might discuss political issues, and that would or wouldn't be appropriate, just depending. You know, sometimes those are become very argumentative, and other times they don't. It just depends, right? So it's a difficult thing, kind of walking this fine line, particularly in a society where all of these things are observed, right? And this, frankly, has always been a part of my motivation for moving to Israel. Right, because in Israel, you know, which is predominantly Jewish, and, you know, there's many Arabs living in the land, most of them are Muslims, there is no Easter or Christmas, right? When I lived there, there was no Halloween either, right? These aren't things I mean, you never have to wonder what day it is or how close we are to a holiday, because the calendar that you use is the biblical calendar, right? So, you know, when it's the 25th of Adar, that Passover is going to be in 3 weeks, right? You don't have to look at your English calendar and try to make the connection and see how far away something is. So these are issues that we wrestle with here. Right, but part of the cost associated with living here. Good, thank you, Avid. Anybody else before we go?
Bob.
Yeah.
I'd like to comment, and I really appreciated, Avid, your comments. As you were sharing, Avid, I felt like you were telling my story for Melody and I, because, you know, I remember Hosea 3:3. How can two walk together unless they first agree to walk together?
Yeah.
And when you're attempting to walk together, but you're not in alignment, it creates frustration and friction, and things feel like, well, it's like driving your car when your wheels are not aligned. It feels like something is shaking and about to fall off. And sometimes it does. So I really appreciated, Avid, your heart. I hear it and I feel it in my own soul. But when I think about, if we were to stand back just for a moment and think about holidays in general in this country. Now, Avid, it might be some of the similar ways where you're at. But in the Western world, it seems that most people, and there are exceptions to what I'm about to say, individual exceptions, maybe even some certain groups, but generally, even with holidays like Easter and Christmas, July the 4th, Thanksgiving, Halloween, and some of the more current holidays that are newer, like Martin Luther King Day in this country, these holidays come around, and it seems to me that they're largely an opportunity to not have to work. People might cognitively know what the holiday represents, but it seems to me, by and large, people just don't go to work that day. It's a paid time off, and they go to the beach, or they have a picnic, or whatever other tradition their family has, or their circle of friends have. Cinco de Mayo. You know, this is not Mexico, but people celebrate Cinco de Mayo here. I live in Arizona. It's a big thing. When I lived in Texas, it was a big thing. When I lived in California, it was a big thing. Cinco de Mayo. Why? Because it's an opportunity to go have some margaritas somewhere. And, hey, who doesn't like a good margarita? So, I think, generally speaking, it seems that all of us, and not just the current generation, even the generations before us, we've been slowly disconnecting from what was the birth of the holiday or the festival. And I think that's true across the board, and I think it's particularly true with these it's been right at 2,000 years since the crucifixion and the resurrection of Yeshua. We are a long ways from that. And we're even further from the event of Passover and God bringing Israel out of bondage in Egypt. So it's not just the time, though, that we're removed. There have been influences along the way that have been intentional to dilute the message. And it makes it really difficult because I read things like, for a lack of knowledge, my people perish. And we see something like that in Hosea, and we see that in Isaiah. Of course, my people is referring to the house of Israel. But they perish. They experience destruction because of a lack of knowledge. But it's not just cognitive knowledge. It's not just it's a piece of information I know. It's more than that, because Yada is much more encompassing. So the truth is, even though I might know what the origins of Christmas is and why it's on December 25, there's a rhythm, there's a momentum, there's that syncretism that predates me many, many generations. And who am I? What influence do I have? What power do I have to start separating those things? And I don't know, does that connect with something that Yeshua said in response to the disciples when he said, let the wheat and tares grow together, I'll separate them at another time? I don't know. Maybe that relates, maybe it doesn't, but it's really, really difficult. And I really appreciated, Bob, your comment about that if in these holiday seasons, whatever they are, whatever date on the calendar they fall, if they afford us an opportunity to connect with family and with friends, with people in the community, maybe that's where our focus needs to be, because I also know that we're dying. And as a people, as a society, we're deteriorating because of a lack of connection.
Yeah.
With one another. I mean, sincere connection, real connection. I really love it that we have this Zoom meeting, because Bob, and Aviv, we remember what it used to be like 10 years ago. You know,
yeah.
we were hearing, but we weren't seeing.
Yeah.
It's sort of like a biblical thing. You know, you can hear, but you can't see. So now we can hear and we can see. So we're a little bit more connected now. So I really appreciate that. Man, Benita, you remember when we used to meet together in person? In our different houses, different places? Maryland, we've been together before. So when we have those opportunities, it's even more rich.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I think that that's an important comment, Bob, that you made about when these things happen, let us who do know, who have this information, not allow that to interfere with the opportunity to connect with family and friends and community and to engage and to interact. Maybe we can't be aligned on every single point, whether it be religious or political or some other ideology. But wherever we can be aligned, it's important.
Absolutely. Yep. Very good. Thank you, Roderick. I like the analogy of the vehicle that is misaligned. I don't know if, obviously, Roderick, you've had that experience. I have as well. You know, it's very difficult getting the vehicle to go in the direction you want it to because it keeps on wanting to turn to the left, turn to the right. Or like you say, you get up to a certain speed and it shakes. It feels like it's going to fall apart. Right? It's a simple resolution. Right? But, you know, when the wheels are not aligned, it feels like the car has a mind of its own, which is what relationships are like when two people are not aligned, right? Yeah, it's very hard. At any rate, thank you. Good. Appreciate you sharing those things. Anybody else before we go?
I have a question.
Yes.
Going back to 1 Corinthians, since that you had 7, 12, and 14.
Yeah.
Talking about non-believers.
Yes.
So, if they married a non-believer, that meant they wasn't worshiping idols. They just was what? Didn't just believe in Yeshua or what?
Well, they're in Corinth, for example. We're talking about a what would have been a messianic synagogue, right, in the first century. There would have been Jews who believed in Yeshua, and Gentiles who believed or trusted that Yeshua was the Messiah, and there probably would have been non-Messianic Jews and non-Messianic Gentiles that had a heart for God and attended the congregation because it provided it provided an opportunity to spend time with a community and pray together, right? So these are people, the non-believers would have been people who, you know, were attracted to a community. And you have to remember that in these days, particularly in places like Corinth, it's not like there were a lot of congregations to go to, a lot of synagogues to go to. I mean, you know, if you live in New York, you can go to any number of synagogues within walking distance of your home, right? When I lived in Jamestown in the Sierra foothills, the closest conservative synagogue, any synagogue, was a little over an hour away, right? So it was something that I could go to or we could go to on Shabbat or on holidays, but it wasn't easy to attend regularly scheduled events that happened during the week, for example, because it was just, you know, not in our area. So I think that was probably the case with first century congregations too, particularly in Asia Minor, where the community was predominantly Greek. And, you know, there were all kinds of other ethnic groups represented too. But the fact is that Jewish communities, they tended to, you know, keep to themselves and live in neighborhoods, much like neighborhoods work in the modern world, with Chinatown or Japantown or Koreatown or other places where members of a particular ethnic group tend to coalesce. So I would guess that in these congregations there was lots of people, people who were interested in what was going on, people who wanted to gather together with the community to pray together. Because in a synagogue, nobody cares what anybody really believes in a synagogue. I mean, in a synagogue, in a church, for example, you can only become a member of a church if you ascribe to their particular theological views on things, right? But synagogues don't have that. If you're Jewish, you are welcome to go to a synagogue, any synagogue. And if you're a Gentile that has a heart for the things of God, you can go too and participate in the services. I mean, that's what's important about a synagogue, is the community coming together for services and to pray together and to worship God. That's kind of what, that's the service a synagogue provides, right? So, I think Paul's instruction here is a warning based upon the language he uses, that believers not be unequally yoked with idolaters, right? Not necessarily people who don't believe exactly like we do about some things. Because that kind of homogeneous perspective is not true of Jews generally, right? It's true of Christians, but not Jews generally. Yeah. Hope that answers the question. Yeah. And by the way, that's my view of it, and obviously there are many other views of this as well, but the language of the text drives me to that conclusion, and his allusion to the various passages that have to do with idolatry. I think Paul's concern is believers and idolaters attempting to connect together, because he's concerned about what the outcome would be, that the believer will be drawn away to idolatry. Yeah, that's, I think, what Paul is concerned about. Good, thank you, Benita. Any other comments before we go?
Real quick, I was going to add to what Dr. Logan was saying about the holidays and being a thing about not having to work.
Yeah.
And there's other aspects of the world that are pushing these holidays. For other reasons, like, you know, it's time for sale. Go out and spend a bunch of money. Or buy a bunch of things, and you got people fighting over stuff in stores. So that's really not what this is supposed to be about, but that's what the world is trying to create or has created. Maybe it's just, it's helping me. I think it makes it easier for me to get away from those falsely prescribed celebrations and appreciate what they're really about.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ed, one of the things I very much appreciate about what you just said is I didn't even think about it until you just mentioned it, the emphasis on the commercial viability of holidays and how important holidays have become because of their commercial viability. But if you think about it, I wonder how attractive the concept of commercial viability would be if these holidays were celebrated in the way they were intended, as opposed to what they've become. Right? I mean, frankly, I think that that the you know, the kind of syncretism that has taken place is in part what drives the commercial aspect of these holidays. Yeah, that's a good thought.
Yeah, they're even creating new holidays. Like, you know, with Black Friday, now there's this Black Monday and a few other things all about, you know, making a profit. Kind of sad, actually.
Yeah, it is sad in some ways, but it's I'm not sure how to say this exactly, but at least the emphasis on a Black Friday or a Black Monday, at least its intentions are straightforward. It's not associated with any... It doesn't pretend to be a religious holiday in disguise. Its objectives are obvious, right? Yeah, good. Good. Thank you, Ed. Anybody else before we go?
There's some comments in the chat, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I always neglect looking at those. Thank you. From Rivka, too cold for bugs in Iceland. Maybe that's maybe that's part of it. From Tina, great lesson, Bob. Thank you. I must be going now. Shabbat shalom, Shavua tov. Tina was with us earlier. She had Taylor in bed and James on a date play date with some friends. So she had a little time. From Susanna, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Comment, the matzah also represents Messiah by the holes and stripes better than an egg. My opinion only, well, the egg doesn't represent the Messiah in any way. I mean, the egg has nothing to do with the Messiah. The egg on Easter has nothing to do with Messiah. It has to do with fertility, which is what the holiday of Easter is about, fertility. Right? So there's no pretense. At least I've never heard anyone suggest that the colored eggs are connected in any way to the Messiah. And also, would Ruth's husband and his brother violated this law against intermarriage? No, they didn't. My understanding is Ruth converted after his death, or did she just reaffirm her faith to the God of Israel and his people when she decided to go with Naomi? The other daughter-in-law went home to her family and people. She didn't convert. As far as we know, she didn't convert. The conversion of Ruth is just something that is described in the literature because of her connection to the tribe of Judah. She marries Boaz. She's connected to the tribe of Judah. She becomes an ancestor of King David and an ancestor of the Messiah. Right? So the words that she expresses, your God will be my God, your people will be my people, those are the kinds of things that she says, at least that we know of, that are affirmations of her commitment to the God of Israel. So we don't actually know when her conversion took place, and it wasn't the kind of formal conversion that exists today. Right? There were conversions in biblical times. We know of them because the Bible talks about them, and they're discussed in the rabbinic literature with regard to various people, but it wasn't the kind of formal process. I mean, today, a conversion requires, you know, you attend a synagogue, you take classes, you go before a Beit Din court of three judges, three rabbis. They ask you questions, you answer questions, you have to renounce your former faith, that kind of thing. All right, so those things all happen in Ruth's life, but not in the kind of formal way that we think of the process as working today. So no, and the guy, and I can't think of off the top of my head, the guy who married Rahab, he wasn't violating the principle either. Rahab, you know, trusted God. And she is integrated into the tribes too. And Tamar. And Bathsheba, right? So, those are the four women in the genealogy of Yeshua that are mentioned. And none of them are Jewish as far as we know. Although there is some question about Bathsheba and Tamar. But we don't really know. The text does not provide their genealogy. So, Suzanne, I hope that worked. From Rivka, when we are engaged with our communities, Jewish or other, the time it takes to celebrate and participate fully in either leaves room for no other. Yes, from her experience, she says, and I would agree. I mean, if you're really involved in a Jewish community, it seems like there is so much going on that there just really isn't time to do much else. From Viola, thank you, Rivka. That would be my experience as well. From Viola, is Christmas pagan? The things that are done in the celebration of Christmas are associated with Christian or pagan rituals. Christmas, like Easter, most of the things done in connection with the celebration of Christmas are a part of a pagan festival called the Feast of Saturnalia. The Feast of Saturnalia existed in the Greek world before the birth of Yeshua. Yeshua was not born on December 25th. In my opinion, he was born during Passover in the year he was born for a variety of reasons. But shepherds were not shepherding their flocks in the hills outside Bethlehem in December. It may not seem like it from the pictures that people see, but it gets cold in Israel in December and January and February. The shepherds that are mentioned in the Gospels were, in my opinion, temple shepherds. They pastored temple sheep that were intended to be sacrificed at Passover, and they were out in the fields approximately a month, before Passover was observed, right? So they would have been the ones that the angels made the announcement to. And this is something that we talk about in a bit of detail in the gospel study on Thursday night from the earlier studies on the birth of Yeshua. So the tree, the lights, the exchanging of gifts, the mistletoe, the Yule log, everything or most things associated with Christmas are developed or introduced into the celebration from various cultures, but broadly the celebration of Christmas as it exists today is the Feast of Saturnalia that existed in the time before Yeshua was born. From Avid, the choice of December 25th may have been influenced by pre-existing pagan festivals. One commonly cited influences, the Roman festival of Saturnalia, which was celebrated from December 17th to the 23rd. Saturnalia was a time of feasting, gift-giving, and merrymaking. Another significant influence is the celebration of Sol Invictus, of the unconquered sun, a festival dedicated to the sun god, which was held on December 25th. The winter solstice, which occurs around this time, was a period of various festivals across different cultures celebrating the rebirth of the sun as the days began to lengthen. Yeah, so this is what Saturnalia and Sol Invictus, this is what these holidays were all about, which is, by the way, why the church connected, just like the church connected the celebration of the resurrection, which represents new life, to an existing pagan celebration having to do with new life and fertility, which spring represents. They did the same thing with December. They associated the birth of the Yeshua is the light of the world with an existing pagan celebration that celebrates the light, right? So they have done it throughout the centuries. It's not, in, you know, it is probably still being done in some places where they imagine that they're going to convert pagans to Christianity by exchanging pagan religious symbols with Christian religious symbols and convincing people to engage in these old rituals with new meanings, right? So what Aviv mentions here is absolutely correct, that in the winter the days get shorter and shorter and shorter, and it's a time of great difficulty for people, particularly in the ancient world, and the fact that the days get longer and longer again on December 21st, 22nd, sometimes the winter solstice, right? The days gradually start getting longer and longer. So the sun was worshipped, and it was regarded as a regeneration of the sun. The sun was getting progressively weaker, and with the winter solstice, the sun has a victory against the darkness. The light has a victory against darkness, and the days get longer and longer again. Right, that's kind of the way it works. So it was a well-defined existing time of celebration that was adopted by the church and turned into the Christian celebration of Christmas. For better or for worse, that's what it is. Very good. Thanks, Aviv. There's a part of it, I didn't finish his comment. In fact, it's not biblical at all. It's a festival with a cultural syncretism. The blending of pagan and Christian elements is part of the natural process of cultural adaptation, which we fight against, right? It is cultural adaptation, that's correct. December 25th from Rivka is associated with the religion of Mithra, the Mithraites, right? Mithras is the god of the Mithraites. So that's important too. So they took various elements and blended them together, right? And it's interesting because the birth of Mithras, in some ways, counterfeits the birth of Messiah. Thank you, Rivka. From Susanna, the syncretism makes me think of the call God had for Israel to come out from among them and be holy as he is holy. We are called to this as well, being believers in Messiah and part of Israel. Maybe when we have opportunity, we can share this, absolutely. Also from Rivka, syncretism reminds me of Hellenism, Hanukkah. That's true, right? Hanukkah is the celebration when Antiochus Epiphanes attempted to Hellenize the Jewish people, to syncretize them with the rest of the pagan world. And at Hanukkah, the Jewish people, some Jews, did aspire to be connected to the broader world and engaged in some of the idolatry that that Antiochus and his people embraced, right? But the Jewish people generally did not. And they revolt against his anti-Torah legislation, his anti-Jewish legislation. And in gaining a victory, they realize that they could press forward and achieve political autonomy as well as religious autonomy, which is what happens. Right? So Israel becomes an independent nation again after in the on the heels of Hanukkah, or the events connected with it. Right? So Hanukkah, you know, is a holiday in which we celebrate remaining as a distinct people and not submitting to this syncretistic process, right? So it's a very, very important holiday. Good. Thank you, Rivka. Anybody else before we go?
Rabbi, Dr. Logan quoted something from Hosea, said that my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And if we read on, it says because they had rejected knowledge.
Yes.
So it's like when you become aware of something, now you have a responsibility, I guess, to make a choice, whether or not you're going to walk in the light or knowledge that you have, or you're going to kind of make pretend that you really don't know. And the thing that's interesting, Ed mentioned about the commercialization of the holidays, and it's like when you start diluting something or misaligning it, at first it may not seem to you to be a big issue, but as you go further along, you are way off course. And it's very subtle how these holidays have really, if you would ask a child or someone about Christmas or Easter, there would be no connection at all to Messiah.
Yeah. From there. Which there isn't. That's the irony. Is for many people, Christmas has nothing to do with Yeshua, and neither does Easter. Right? For many Americans, these two holidays have absolutely no religious significance whatsoever. They're just fun things to do. That's exactly true. Yeah. Now, I don't remember if I've told this story, but when I was in the Marine Corps, I was an aircraft electrician, and we had a variety of different planes on the base where I was stationed, and we had a twin-engine Piper Aztec, a small twin-engine airplane. You know, it only held a few people. Something with its automatic pilot had gone wrong, and nobody, including me, was trained on how to fix it. So somebody above me called the manufacturer of this automatic pilot in Mineral Wells, Texas. And so I was sent to Mineral Wells, Texas, to watch them fix it and to be trained on how to take care of it, right? To fix it in the future. The only problem is it's a little airplane, so they had to fix it. They had to fix the plane itself. So I and a pilot flew to Mineral Wells, Texas, from Southern California. It's about, what, about 1,500 miles, 1,000 miles, maybe 1,200, 1,400 miles anyway, without an automatic pilot, which means that I had to fly the plane for part of the trip because he couldn't fly it by himself the whole time, right? So we traded off. One of the things that he made sure to emphasize was that when I was flying the plane, I had to make sure that we were flying on the exact heading that we were supposed to, right? And it's exactly what you just said, David, because that's what he told me. He said, you know, if you veer from the heading, it won't seem like we are very much off course at the beginning, right? But after a few hours, you could be hundreds of miles away from where we're going, right? I mean, you know, so when I was flying the plane, I had to make sure that I was, you know, constantly watching the compass and constantly making sure that we were on the right heading so we could get to where we were going. And he didn't have to correct, you know, he didn't have to correct my error. You know, after every couple of hours we would switch off, you know. So it was kind of funny. But anyway, we went to Mineral Wells, Texas, and got the automatic pilot fixed, and it wasn't a problem flying back. The flight back was a lot less taxing. At any rate, that's exactly what happens, right? It doesn't seem like it's a big discrepancy in the beginning, but like you said, at the end, nobody has any idea what they're even doing. Yeah, and the other thing you said is correct too. I don't know if you noticed everybody nodding their heads. As you accumulate information, you become responsible for it. Right. I had someone in my congregation one time who I had this discussion with about Christmas. And as we were talking, you know, she just didn't want to hear it. So I, you know, her husband was Jewish and he was also a part of the congregation, and she very desperately wanted to hold on to Christmas because she loved it, right? And conversation, I asked her, you know, aren't you the least bit curious about where Christmas comes from? And she said, no, I'm not. It was irrelevant for her. She loved Christmas. That was all there was to it.
Bob, it reminds me, Melody and I lived in, well, she lived there in Fresno, California, before she and I met. But after we met and were married, we lived there for a time. And I remember seeing a billboard in Fresno in the late 70s that said, Jesus, the reason for the season.
Right.
Which, you know, in those days, that seemed like a clever little statement, and a lot of people latched on to it, and every year you'll hear folks mentioning that. But what's interesting is the origin of that statement, or that phrase, Jesus, the reason for the season. It was the slogan of an ad campaign of a company that made Christian t-shirts, or t-shirts that had Christian messages on it in the
leads.
That was an ad campaign slogan. That's where that came from. So, Ed, that connects with your thought about how these holidays have become commercialized. And they benefit, the marketers benefit from the allegiance and the emotional connection that people have to these ideas that we're discussing. And they take advantage of that emotional connection to get into their pocketbook.
Oh, that's very interesting. I have seen the slogan on billboards like you. And I've heard it said many times. Whenever I see it or hear it, I always think to myself, Jesus is not the reason for the season. Right? Mithras is the reason for the season. Right? But, you know, it's... but that's... You're right. That's the... that's exactly what is sometimes said. It's interesting that that was a... an ad campaign. Very clever one, by the way.
There's also the Keep the Christ in Christmas.
Yes, that's another one.
And Melody just mentioned the WWJD. What would you...
Oh, yeah, right.
It was also a slogan of an ad campaign. It was about selling product.
Interesting. Attending synagogue was probably not one of the responses they imagined. Celebrating the holidays.
Going 8 days with unleavened bread.
Yeah.
It's not poetic. I'm sorry. It just doesn't have that ring to it.
Yeah.
Marilyn, maybe you and I can work on that, and we can create something there. What do you think?
Yeah.
Rabbi, I wanted to say this, that is a lot of things with God's name on. God didn't put His name. People put their name, put His name in it.
Yeah.
And it's associating it with God, and it's in no way God endorsed that. But what to me is really attractive, and I like and admire so much about the Jewish observances, is that the things that they actually do have a connection to what is in the Bible, in the Word of God, and it has significance and meaning.
Yes, that's part of what appeals to me too. That's why, you know, that's one of the things that I love about the holidays is bringing these events to life and preserving them and identifying with them, right? It helps us to be connected to what God has accomplished in the past, and therefore it makes it possible to trust Him with what He is doing with our lives in the present and in the future. Right? Yeah, that's an important, important consideration. Absolutely. Very much so.
I shared this thought earlier this week. It's a passage from Jeremiah. And the prophet Jeremiah said to the prophet Hananiah, "Listen, Hananiah, the Lord did not send you, and you have given this people lying assurances. Assuredly, said the Lord, I am going to banish you from off the earth. This year you shall die, for you have urged disloyalty to the Lord." So here's a prophet who prophesies on his own terms, delivers a message that's his, but not the message of the Lord.
Right.
It's interesting in that passage is that this prophet's name is Hananiah, which means God favors. And it reminds me of my history working with TV evangelists who claim to have the anointing or the special calling, so everything they do is God,
right,
or godly, or right, or sanctioned by the Lord, because they got the name. If you sow seeds of disloyalty to the Lord, to the Torah, there is a whirlwind to be reaped. And those who align themselves with that are going to get caught up in that destruction.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. Thank you, Roderick. I agree. Also from Rivka, that year I quit Christmas. I had 126 collectible ornaments, handmade, cross-stitch, embroidery for everyone. I shut my eyes, gathered it all up, and burned it down to the last red and green thread. Guess what David said? Doing the Jewish festivals requires being a baker, a carpenter, a seamstress, tailor, and a candlestick maker. Yeah, celebrating the holidays is very much a hands-on activity, which frankly is one of the reasons why it's so memorable, right? And part of why it has the impact it does. Also from Susanna, thank you, Rivka. One time after our study and we discussed Christian holidays, you said none of them were biblical to see for myself. I looked them all up and found that to be true. It was a bit shocking. Yeah, it is a great shock. I agree. From Ed, I had a similar experience to Rivka's. I used to have ornaments and lights and decorations. Over time, I got rid of them. And as you do, like Ed says here, it gets easier. Right? Never easy, but easier. Well, it's not easy when you live in a place where there is such a commercialization of it, right? I mean, it's one of the things that, I mean, I hope this isn't a problem to admit, but it's one of the things that drives me absolutely berserk is when I go into a Home Depot in October and they're already doing Christmas music. I mean, it's like, oh my God. I mean, we haven't even celebrated, there hasn't even been Hanukkah yet. I mean, Halloween or Thanksgiving. And they're already playing Christmas music. It used to just, it was during those times that I thought to myself, Israel, here I come. It was very, anyway. Also from Rivka, I do blue and white for the winter solstice, not pagan, just because deep in the winter nights, plus helps blend into the neighborhood. But my family, when I was growing up, we used to put blue lights up on, on parts of our home in celebration of Hanukkah. Right, so that is something that some Jews do, is they use blue lights at Hanukkah. And, sometimes Hanukkah and Christmas coincide. Sometimes they don't. But listen, we have a neighbor here who still illuminates their holiday with the Christmas lights every night. I think to myself, I hope they're LED. And it's pretty, right? It's pretty. It's just August, so I don't know. Don't get it, but that's okay. I want to bring back wassailing, singing at the doors in the deep winter nights. Any song, not necessarily religious. Yeah, I don't know if any of you had people coming around singing songs in your neighborhood when you were a kid. We did. Anyway.
Call it caroling.
What's that?
We call it caroling.
Caroling.
Robert, Marcela wants to tell a dream that she had when she finally understood what was going on with Christmas. So I will let Marcela, and I'm going to translate to Marcela.
Okay. Hi, everyone. A dream that I had maybe 5 years ago, my family is Catholic. And in that night, I wasn't thinking about Christmas. It wasn't Christmas time. But suddenly, yo soñé que venía en una barca. Como sucia yo.
Yeah, so my family is Catholic. I was not planning in or thinking about Christmas. And that night, I had a dream. And I was in a little ship, in a little boat. And what happened in the boat?
And yo me bajé. Y de repente veo a mi familia en una gran celebración con una mesa muy hermosa, flores y comida.
Okay, so I came down from the boat. And suddenly I saw my family in the middle of a big celebration, you know, with a big table, a lot of decoration in them. But the decoration was related to?
It's only was flowers.
Ah, just flowers. Okay, okay.
Sí, pero yo no lograba, no comía de esa, no comía en la mesa, no comía nada.
But I was in the table and I didn't eat nothing at all in the table.
Y el pastor que estaba en esa mesa de repente me aparta y empieza a orar.
So, there was a pastor, and the pastor take me from a moment and start to pray.
Y lo extraño de esto es que él empezó a orar en el nombre del Dios Saturno.
So, the weird thing about the dream is that the pastor, when he was going to finish the prayer, he started to pray in the name of the god Saturn.
Y yo solo me le quedaba viendo, extrañada, porque decía, ¿por qué está orando en nombre de Saturno?
I mean, and I was looking at him in the middle of my dream and saying, why is he praying in the name of Saturn?
Y de repente el pastor me dio. Se detuvo orar, se detuvo de la oración y me dijo, ¿por qué no dices nada?
So he stopped the praying and he asked me directly, why you don't say nothing at all?
Porque yo solamente me les quedaba viendo y yo no ni les decía esto está mal ni los paraba. Entonces él me decía nuevamente, ¿por qué no dices nada?
In the dream, I didn't do much. I didn't do much. Oh, sorry. It was Daniela. In the dream, I didn't do much. I was not capable to say this is wrong or nothing. I didn't do nothing at all. So the dream finished when Marcela, you know, finally wake up that morning and says to herself, I need to investigate a little bit more of Christians. So she started Google, you know, the story, Christmas and everything, and she said, oh, I didn't know what was going on. Oh, so.
Estaban estas Saturnalias que eran en una mesa grande, siempre los romanos.
So I start reading and I understood that all the flowers that I saw in the table was the Saturnalias, which are kind of a flower, and those are the flowers that were in the table.
Y lo difícil es que muchas veces nos quedamos callados. No eran tal vez nada relacionado con mi familia, pero sí a quedarnos callados y no decir esto está mal y no apartarnos.
And the difficult part of this is that in the dream I was not capable to take apart, I mean, to take myself apart and say, look, this is wrong. But I couldn't say nothing in the dream.
Muchas veces porque estamos con personas que tal vez son mucha autoridad para nosotros. En mi caso era como un pastor y mi familia.
And sometimes because there were a lot of people with a lot of authority, like my family or this pastor, I was not capable to say anything.
Entonces estoy segura que fue el Señor diciéndome, tienes que hablar, apartarte y decir las cosas tal cual son.
So I am pretty sure that it was God to wake me up and it was a way of God like saying, hey, listen, you need to do something about it.
Y para mí fue muy claro, porque jamás hubiera soñado con Saturno, jamás hubiera soñado con algo como eso, nunca lo había escuchado.
Por mí,
sí fue un mensaje de Dios para mí en cuanto a las tradiciones, en cuanto a las fiestas paganas.
For me, this message was very direct, because I mean, I was not thinking even in Saturn or in Christmas, but God gave me this direct message in my dreams.
Wow. Baruch Hashem. When was that? Was that recently?
I don't know, maybe 3 years ago,
oh,
I think.
Okay.
Five years ago.
Yeah. Good, wow. Baruch Hashem. Good, thank you. Tell Marcella it was nice to see her finally.
Fue bueno verte, finalmente. Thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah. Thank you. From Beth Ann wrote, at my local Walmart, they already have Halloween things and sweaters. And she said, it's 97 degrees today. You know, I took, when Avid was here, we went to, he took my grandson to the Mall of America. It's the largest mall in the United States. It's a remarkable place, but they have a Halloween store that was already open in the Mall of America. You know, a costume store, a Halloween costume store, which is closed for a lot of the year, right? It's just open for Halloween, and it's already open too. Also from Susanna, maybe one time we can talk about how to enjoy the season, sounds, smells, etc. without the pagan elements. She asks if there is a book on this, not that I know of, but the rabbi's wife from the Chabad that I attended in Southern California, she used to love Christmas time of year, not obviously because of Christmas, but she loved the lights. Right? She enjoyed seeing all the lights, and it was just people seemed to be more considerate of each other, and she enjoyed seeing the lights. So that was something that she enjoyed. Obviously, they didn't celebrate Christmas or have anything to do with it, but she did appreciate and enjoy the lights. So that's kind of an interesting thing. I think there are other people who feel that way as well. Thank you, Susanna. From Melody and Radu, Shabbat Shalom to all. We love you all. We must go. Shavuot Tov. From Rivka, that's a heavy dream, Marcella. It is indeed. Maybe we should all collaborate and write one from Rivka. It would be a good thing to talk about. Maybe that is, I'm sure something will come up and we can talk about these things. So, I'm not sure that there's any one proper way of doing it. So, having input in a discussion like this would be great to have a time to, you know, to kind of talk about how we can enjoy the various seasons and the sounds and the smells of the year without all of the pagan trappings. Yeah, it's a good idea. So, the earth is the Lord, let us rejoice and be glad. Amen. That from Rivka as well. Baruch Hashem. Good. Anybody else before we go? Great discussion.
Thank you all.
Amen. Thank you all. Yep. Very good. Okay. Oh, this is from Viola. I had a dream about the Hispanic Day of the Dead. It's not Hispanic, it's Catholic, the Day of the Dead. Halloween is associated with It's the evening of All Saints' Day, which is a Catholic holiday. So Halloween is All Hallows' Eve. That's where the name Halloween comes from. And it's the evening of All Saints' Day, which is November 1st. So All Hallows' Eve is October 31st, right? So it's a holiday connected with death and the dead. That's where it comes from. So, but it's like everything else these days. It has very little to do with that, right? I mean, you know, kids these days, I mean, I don't know how many of them actually say trick or treat when they get up to the door of a person's home or just hold their bag open, you know. It's just hard to know, but like many holidays, it's religious significance has, you know, is long gone, and it's replaced by, you know, what is essentially a big costume party, right? I mean, and adults, by the way, are into it more than children these days, right? I mean, they go to Halloween parties where people get dressed up and they go in costumes. I mean, it's anyway, it's interesting. Very good. Okay, anybody else before we go? Thank you, Viola. Okay, very good. Then I will say, Lila Tove, may the Lord be with you. Appreciate seeing all of you. It was a wonderful conversation, and some good things were shared and expressed, so I'll look forward to seeing you during the week. God bless you. May the Lord be with you, and we'll keep Elaine in prayer, and hopefully we'll hear from her soon. So, and things are in Bermuda are okay. So God bless you guys. Laila Tov.
Bye guys. Laila Tov. Shabbat Tov. Bye.
Shabbat Tov. Thank you. Bye for now.